The Mark Stein Club presents Tales for Our Time.
Plum Duff. Step 1. On the day after Stir-Up Sunday, Pam realized she had forgotten the Christmas pudding. Such a thing had never happened before. She did not, in fact, observe Stir-Up Sunday, not because it was a churchy thing, but because her grandmother had regarded the date as far too late for a proper plum duff. Granny would have known the relevant, not Bible verse, what was it? Pam googled. Oh yeah, the collect. Stir up, we beseech thee, O Lord, the wills of thy faithful people, that they, plenteously bringing forth the fruit of good works, may of thee be plenteously rewarded. Stir up Sunday was the Sunday before Advent, which to Granny's mind was cutting it too fine for a good Christmas pudding. So Granny, or maybe Granny's Granny, for it was a long tradition in the family, had designated 4 Saturdays before Stir-Up Sunday as the day for pudding making. And ever since, down through the generations, mother and children had spent that early November day in the kitchen, stirring up the fruits of good works in a mixing bowl, with the young'uns getting to pour in the rum. Hence the name of their annual ritual, Soak It Up Saturday. And so it had been observed every year, until this year. Pam counted back the weeks and tried to work out why she'd forgotten. Was it when Gareth had been talking about how maybe they should go away for Christmas? One of those bargain ski breaks in Bulgaria? Or when the committee had said they might have to cancel the Yuletide fair because of the cost of the security bollards? Pam had inherited the job of principal purveyor of puddings to the community Christmas party from her mother. But someone had suggested it might be nice to have a holidays around the world theme this year. But no, that was the first meeting, in September. So the more Pam thought about it, the more she realized that she had just forgotten. A family tradition had died through absent-mindedness. She felt bad about it, and when her daughter came home from school, she told her they'd have to do the pudding right now. Chloe was going through a whiny phase. But it's Monday. Well, we'll call it Mix-Up Monday, Pam said, and slapped her thigh like a principal boy in the village panto. Chloe whined on. She had too much homework, and anyway, she'd seen a Christmas pudding Tesco that was hollow, with toffee ice cream and mini marshmallows in the middle, and why didn't Leo have to do it? But Leo wasn't home yet, as usual. For a moment, Pam blamed the obliteration of the family tradition on her children, and then silently rebuked herself. In the kitchen, they did the same jokes they always did. "Why are there no plums in plum pudding?" asked Chloe. At this point, Leo was supposed to add, "And why is there no toad in the hole?" And their mum would reply, "There is in mine." And Chloe would make a face or go, "Ugh." But Leo was off with his mates, and they couldn't work out how to do the lines with just the two of them. The ritual felt dead, and Pam didn't know how to resurrect it. The recipe had been in the family since the 19th century, when her great-great-great-whatever had been cook at the manor back in the Packwoods time. That's why it was Barbados rum, because the Packwoods had owned a plantation there. Pam had gone caroling at the manor in her school days, the longest drive in the village and the scariest on a starless night, unless you had a boy to snuggle with. Barbados rum and currants from Australia, but she couldn't remember why. She looked at the pan of boiling water. "Everything's evaporating," she said out loud. "You're daft, Mum. I just put more water in." "Will you do this with your daughter?" "Threaty on," Chloe hissed wheezily through her braces. "This is the very first Mix-Up Monday ever. We don't know whether we'll like it enough to make it a tradition, do we?" She went over to the counter to check on the next step, from a recipe written in quavery hand in an old lined exercise book with Thruppence Halfpenny printed on the back on a Maddox label. Pam told her daughter she should try to memorize it.
Why? Leo put it on the cloud last year.
Bloody Mickleham will shut down the cloud.
Little bit of politics, said Chloe, mimicking her dad.
But Pam insisted, so her daughter dutifully recited step one. Combine raisins, currants, sultanas, dried apricots, chopped to size of raisins, dried figs, chopped to size of raisins, and other fruits in a bowl. Add rum. Set aside for at least 8 hours to macerate.
What does macerate mean, Mum?
Macerate, said her mother. Google it. Are you soft in the head? Chloe was already on her phone.
Oh, very funny, Mum.
Get that thing away from the bowl, said Pam.
You put dirty old money in the Christmas pud, Chloe pointed out.
That's different. We wash it, and it was Granny's lucky sixpence. Chloe went whiny again and demanded to know why they couldn't put toffee ice cream in the middle. But the recipe decreed there could only be 13 ingredients. 12 for the disciples, Pam reminded her, plus one for...
The Little Drummer Boy, said Chloe, who hated that song.
They heard her brother come in through the front door, closing it too loudly as usual and heading to join his dad in front of the television.
Leo, called his mum.
He paused warily on the threshold of the kitchen.
Who won? She asked.
The match was cancelled. Didn't you see the text alert? Pam ran a floury hand through her hair. She hadn't looked at the phone since remembering she'd forgotten Soak It Up Saturday.
If the match was cancelled, why are you so late?
Her son was looking at her with an odd expression.
It's on the telly, he said. Come on.
He and Chloe took off, and Pam, after rinsing off the flour, followed. Gareth and the children were giggling at the "and finally" item on the local news. The presenter was reporting that a St. Bede's fourth former had taken his Christmas pudding to school and it had been mistaken for a bomb.
Doth yours explode, Mum? Asked Chloe, still giggling.
Shh, hissed her father. I want to see if they show Leo picking his nose.
Grainy phone footage of the boys' fellow fourth formers trooping into the corridor appeared on the screen.
Is that you? Asked Chloe, behind Trevor Wakefield.
But the picture had changed to something black and spherical on a big platter. Everyone laughed.
You've got to admit, conceded Gareth, that's a scary-looking Christmas pudding, boyo. What's that on the top of it?
That's the fuse, said Leo.
Pam peered at the set.
I think it's a cinnamon stick. That's different.
But before she could make certain, the picture changed to parents standing outside the school gates, and someone from the bomb squad giving the all clear and returning what was left of the pudding after forensic analysis. It was not a pretty sight.
That's what I call mix-up Monday, said Gareth.
Step two.
Grease the pudding basin with melted butter, droned Chloe from the back seat. Line the base with non-stick baking paper.
Can I stop now, she said. I'll do the rest tomorrow.
Is that your bomb-making recipe? Asked Leo, without looking up from his phone. Maybe today Shahid will bring an exploding bacon butty to school. Pam braked suddenly. The shortcut wasn't working this morning. This was worse than the Oxford Road. The radio filled the void left by her daughter's abandoned recipe recitation, and the DJ introduced Bog Off It's Crimbo.
I like this at first, said Chloe, considering the matter gravely. But I don't think it's that funny, really.
Her brother switched stations, but they were in the middle of the news.
His Royal Highness has reached out to the falsely accused so-called pudding bomber, detained for 4 hours at a Gloucestershire school yesterday. In an early morning tweet, the prince said,
Leo was already pulling up His Highness's Twitter account.
Scrumptious-looking pudding, Shahid. All it needs is a little marmalade butter.
The prince had his own line of organic marmalade.
Want to bring it to the palace?
Shahid's going to the palace, marvelled Chloe.
It's not fair, Mum, said Leo. Why don't your puddings get mistaken for bombs?
His Royal Highness had only recently begun tweeting and was rumoured to be distressed that his followers were fewer than Boy George or Elizabeth Hurley, so he had been making an effort to be more eye-catching. The presenter reported that the Prince's morning tweet was already trending and was felt to be an important step in the campaign against Islamophobia.
"St. Bede's is on the news, Mum," said Chloe. "Has that ever happened before?"
Pam lurched forward a few yards and waved at Gareth's friend Keith, who was outside Maddox, as she still thought of it, leaning on one of the new security bollards and reading the paper. This year the bollards were dressed like giant candy canes, which gave Keith the air of a miniature Christmas elf. He was pointing and waving the front page at Pam.
"Maybe it's St. Bede's again," said Chloe.
They turned into School Lane, and the reason for the slow-moving traffic was made plain. Big television trucks blocked one side of the road, and on the other were reporters and cameramen, and a lot of people Pam had never seen before. A policeman peered into the car, saw the school uniforms, and waved them through the narrow space. Outside the school gates, Mr. Callahan himself was supervising the drop-off. Pam wanted to ask him what was going on, but another constable waved her forward, and she had to take the long way round by Millpool Lane to get back to the high street. Pam worked for an estate agent she had known since her school days. When they were 15, at his parents' annual Boxing Day sherry party, Hugo had shown her the stables and slipped his hand under her new Angora sweater. Somewhere in the background, Wizard were singing "I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day," and it had ruined the song for her, which was a pity. If only he'd felt her up to bog off its crimbo. By unspoken agreement, neither of them had ever mentioned the incident again. In the years since, Hugo had worked hard on a hail-fellow well-met manner and didn't like to think about the less assured moments of his youth. But sometimes, come December, they'd be having lunch in the Black Swan, and the holiday tape would play Wizard, and he'd absent-mindedly sing along, and suddenly Pam could see the yellow zit on his nose and feel the heat of his palm hovering on her brow all over again. She wanted to ask him about the hubbub at the school, but he was divorced and got depressed if anyone brought up children. Business was slow, and they walked over the square to the committee meeting early. Hugo's scheme to drum up customers during the Yuletide fair was to invite the owners of his more sluggish properties to decorate their homes and then offer Christmas open house tours. Homemade wreaths, mulled wine perfuming the kitchen, simple centrepieces of boxwood pomegranates and a couple of votive candles. Pam thought the idea was, quote, too American, but Hugo said all the best ideas were. He was old-fashioned like that, she thought. Inside the Guildhall, it was airless and uncomfortable. Ever since they put double glazing in front of the old lead windows, it was either freezing or, with the boiler on, stiflingly hot. The committee members were tetchy. The chair, Rajiv, reported that the cost of the security bollards would be £40,000, and everyone said that seemed a lot for those awful candy canes, which weren't really very English, and what more appropriate seasonal security measures did they have? Rajiv said they were missing the point. £40,000 for bollards would mean the Yuletide fair would have to be cancelled as no longer commercially viable. Fortunately, he had contacted the constituency chair to invite the honourable member to attend the community dinner.
"I say,"
interrupted Isabel, frowning at her phone before turning to Pam, "they've suspended your boy's teacher." Isabel's son went to boarding school. She always referred to Pam's son as your boy.
"Harrop, is it? The chap who started the bomb scare?"
"That's Leo's teacher, yes."
"Well, the assistant head had him escorted off the premises, pending an inquiry. Whoops! Now the assistant head's been suspended. And the head! Where are you getting this?"
"Oh, the Supreme Islamic Council is live tweeting."
Hugo rolled his eyes and corrected Isabel. Surely it was the Islamic Supreme Council. He'd had to sit through a class they taught on appropriate sensitivity measures when showing properties for sale by Muslim clients. But Isabel said no, that was the Islamic Supreme Council of Britain and Ireland, whereas this was the Supreme Islamic Council of England and Wales, a rival group, the South Midlands chapter. Actually, the South Midlands West chapter. Rajiv, whose children were grown and working in America and Luxembourg, was bored by school talk. "As I was saying," he said patiently, "the Member of Parliament has agreed to attend the fair and the community dinner. We are, after all, the oldest Yuletide fair in the county. And as the Honourable Member happens to be the PM, that means Her Majesty's Government will pick up 70% to 80% of the costs of the diversity bollards." Bloody Mickleham, thought Pam. But nobody liked politics at the committee meetings, so all she said was, "Gosh, I never knew we were that close to cancelling the fair." "It's the new reinforced bollards. The old ones won't do any more," said someone whose name she didn't know. When her mum was dying, she'd made Pam promise to take her long-held seats on the music and food committees. In the advance of her dementia, it was almost the last thing her mother could still recall, long after she'd forgotten the grandkids' names. So Pam assumed it was important. But unlike her mum, she was not a committee person. Everything seemed to be much more rule-bound and regimented than it used to be. When her friends went up to uni, they'd come home for the holidays, meet in the pub, and after a couple of drinks decide to go ad hoc carolling for a couple of hours. Then they got jobs in London and Oxford and stopped coming home for Christmas. And now the village had designated carolling zones, bollarded off. On her drive home, Bloody Mickleham was having a bad day. He'd been wrong-footed by the prince's tweet inviting Shahid to bring his Christmas pudding to the palace. Within a few hours, Marco Pierre White, Gordon Ramsay, Jamie Oliver, and many other celebrity chefs began extending offers to Shahid to intern at their restaurants or cook his pudding on their TV shows.
"In Bethlehem, Mary and Joseph found refuge in a stable,"
the Archbishop of Canterbury had told the BBC.
"But in Britain, refugees cannot find shelter in St. Bede's Secondary School."
At Prime Minister's Questions, the Leader of the Opposition had Mr. Mickleham on the back foot, demanding to know what he was going to do about institutional Islamophobia so deeply entrenched that paranoid teachers in the Prime Minister's own constituency were able to put a school in lockdown just because a Muslim brought a Christmas pudding to class.
"Shahid is a credit to the New Britain,"
the legendary Labour firebrand roared from the opposition dispatch box to the delight of the House.
"Where's the old Britain? Has made us a global laughingstock."
He read out various Fleet Street headlines. "Plum crazy. It's plumophobia. Puddin' on the Ritz." This last somewhat forced pun above a story on various human rights groups advising Shahid to sue at the European Court after being detained by the headmistress and an obtuse constable in an anteroom to her office for several hours without access to a solicitor. The PM's response was weak, and the opposition leader ended with a flourish about how surely in a multicultural Britain we can all have our cake and eat it, which everyone thought very witty. The Scottish National Party leader suggested it was time the Sassenach's Islamophobic teachers shut their cake holes, which also got a cheer from the backbenches.
"St. Bede's is the most famous school in England," said Chloe from the back seat.
Even the Prime Minister's own party was dissatisfied with his response. That very morning, the Northern Ireland secretary had taken her children to see Belfast's first ever Muslim Father Christmas. He was a retired imam from County Down called Mohammed, whose beard was authentically white, and who was proving a great hit with loyalist and Republican shoppers alike. The Secretary of State's visit to the department store was agreed to be very shrewd, a shot across the bows of the PM, and perhaps an early move in a possible leadership challenge to Mickleham. Leo wanted some music.
"Why are you listening to this, Mum?"
"Because Bloody Mickleham's coming to the Yuletide Fair."
"Why would he want to come to the most Islamophobic village in England?"
And they all laughed. Step 3.
"Beat the butter and sugar in a bowl until pale and creamy," said Chloe from the back seat.
Police in Scotland, Lancashire and Diffordham Powys, in connection with aggravated tweets by white supremacists about the so-called Christmas pudding bomber. The Chief Constable of West Mercia Constabulary warned today that there would be zero tolerance.
Add eggs, one at a time, beating well after each addition.
The Home Secretary's announcement that two American right-wing bloggers and a Hungarian nationalist politician would be prohibited from entering the United Kingdom.
Stir in breadcrumbs, combine flowers and spices, continued Chloe,
after falsely reporting that the fourth former shouted Allahu Akbar.
Add the fruit mixture and stir until combined. Chloe, complained Leo, I'm trying to listen. Spoon into basin.
You know all this, said Pam, you were there.
Can I call in, Mum? Asked Leo, already getting out his phone.
No, she said, lurching forward for a few yards before coming to another stop.
What's the point of listening to a phone-in if you never phone in? Asked Chloe. Let him do it, Mum, it'll be funny.
No, said Pam. She glanced at Leo. What did he want to say, anyway? But he was in a bad mood now and didn't answer. School Lane was even more chaotic than the day before, with a large demonstration of what Pam took as Londoners, holding up Christmas pudding-shaped placards. Peace on Earth! Stop the hate! Puddings for peace! There was a poster of a smiling Shahid holding a giant whisk. Love beats hate! The protesters were chanting, We don't want your racist fear, refugees are welcome here.
My school's getting some refugees too, said Chloe to Leo as he got out of the car. Then we'll be on the news.
At the office, Hugo was in very good humour, crowing over his principal competitor's failure. An oligarch had been this close to buying the manor, but had changed his mind at the last minute because it didn't have a moat.
I told Rajiv when he put it on the market he needed to stick a moat in. The oligarchs love him. Security barrier.
It wasn't a Russian oligarch. The manor wasn't quite grand enough to catch their eye.
Kazakh, said Hugo, or one of the other stands. There's a yurt at the Yuletide Fair this year, selling organic kumis as a healthy alternative to wassail.
What's kumis?
How should I know? Fermented yak dung or something.
Kumis? That's what we used to say at school when Miss Roberts wore her tight sweater.
Pam hadn't thought about Miss Roberts for a long time. There weren't many teachers from her day still at St. Bede's. In fact, as she thought of it, the now suspended Mr. Harrop was the last. They used to call him Sweetie Harrop because he was believed to be homosexual, although in later years Pam had run into his delightful and comely wife. Still, he was very effeminate and delicate. She could only imagine his reaction to a boy approaching his desk with what appeared to be a bomb. From Leo's telling, Mr. Harrop, having shrieked, Duck! Was the first to hit the floor. Now he was the poster boy for the Guardian's campaign to pension off teachers from the racist and transphobic past and replace them with more enlightened educators, if necessary from overseas. As she'd driven past Maddox, Keith, from his perch on the candy cane bollard, had held up the front page and pointed at poor old Sweetie's picture. Pam marvelled at how the news was suddenly full of people she knew, yet all of them entirely unrecognisable. They crossed the square to the committee meeting, Hugo with a jaunty saunter in his gait from the failed Kazakh bid. Inside the Guildhall, Pam was shown a copy of the fair schedule as approved by the Prime Minister. So, Isabel said briskly, you'll be presenting Archie Mickleham with one of your puddings.
I don't really like him that much.
Little bit of politics, said Hugo, mimicking Gareth.
Well, I'm sure we've all had to present things to people we don't like very much, said Isabel sharply, with a sneer curling the faint moustache on her upper lip.
If it helps, stick a sparkler in the top and make it look like a bomb. They seem to be all the rage.
Heading home, Pam went out of her way to drive past St. Giles's, outside the main village, and built for the manor and its estate. The last churchgoer in the family had been her grandfather, but she and Gareth had been married there, and they'd always gone on Christmas Eve when the kids were too excited to sleep. Then, what was it, 3, 4 years ago, the new vicar had got out his guitar
and sung Mary's Boy Child, but in a bad calypso rhythm, and with Man Shall Live Forevermore Because of Christmas Day, changed to Folks Shall Live Forevermore. And afterwards, Gareth said it was just too naff, so they ceased going. The church bells were ringing, so someone was home. Pam parked and got out. The gravel crunched loudly under her sensible shoes. She'd have to wear heels for the community Christmas lunch, bloody Mickleham. The old part of the church was 12th century. The new part was 13th century. She forgot how many generations of her family had been carried down the worn stone path and through into the nave for their obsequies. Until her mum, the funeral home said elfin safety, had ruled the stones too uneven and unsafe for the pallbearers. So her coffin had to be wheeled on a thing that looked like a Sainsbury's trolley round to the disabled entrance. The door was locked, of course. On early release day at school, she and Glynis would take the long way home and share secrets and cigarettes while perched on Sir Mortimer Packwood's tombstone. Then they'd go inside and look around and pray for favourite boys to ask them out. Now the church was padlocked due to vandalism, and there were no bell ringers ringing the bells. Pam remembered reading something about putting in mechanical chimes, which tended to go off randomly and upset the weekenders from London. Driving back, she again had that sense of wholesale evaporation. This was silly. So what if she forgot Soak It Up Saturday? "You seem a bit frazzled, love," said Gareth, sitting on the floor, untangling the Christmas tree lights. "You're looking at the only woman in the county with the dubious honour of presenting the Prime Minister with her Christmas pudding." "Bloody Mickleham," the kids chorused in unison. The acting headmistress had sent an email about trauma counselling, and neither Pam nor Gareth were in the mood for a serious sit-on-the-edge-of-the-bed talk with Leo. So they agreed they'd both stop by his room before turning in. "Is she very upset about what happened?" asked Pam. Silly question. He was suing at the European Court or something. "No, I think he's enjoying it," said Leo. "Why don't you ask him over to the house? It's nice to have a friend your age who's a little different." "He's not my age. He's like 30. "Don't be ridiculous. He's in the fourth form. The BBC keeps calling him 15-year-old Shahid." Pam looked at the class photo. He loomed over everyone, and with a definite 5 o'clock shadow. "He's dull for his age," said Gareth. "He's hairier than Jethro," said Leo. Jethro was the old gardener and a man whose ears and eyebrows and knuckles bloomed more luxuriantly than any of his flower beds. "Oh, go on, ask him over to the house," his dad urged. "It'll please your ma'am." Pam had a sudden yen to hug her son, but she knew he'd be all embarrassed. "Why don't we all go to church for the midnight service this Christmas?" "Shahid won't want to do that," said Leo. "He's Muslim." "Not Shahid, us, like we used to." Leo was non-committal, which was his way of not giving offence. Pam had no need to ask Chloe to know exactly how her daughter would react. "Oh, Mum, boring."
Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time is a production of Oak Hill Media and Mark Stein Enterprises. All rights reserved. Join us next time. The Mark Stein Club presents Tales for Our Time.
Plum Duff. Step 4. Chloe had taken to singing her recipe memorization exercises. "Place the pudding in a large saucepan and pour hot water halfway up the sides. Cover and steam, cover and steam,
Caverns steam for 6 hours.
That's enough, said Pam, shifting into fifth gear for the first time this week. And if Mrs. Mickleham asks you for the recipe, on no account are you to warble at her.
I probably won't talk to her, decided Chloe. Veronica's mum says she's a racist.
Pam turned to her son, who was scrolling intently. What was it you wanted to call that radio show about?
Oh, never mind.
Leo was silent for a moment.
It's a funny thing, News, he said deliberatively.
How so?
Well, something happens and it lasts 10 minutes, and then the news talks about it for days and days, and the something that happened becomes something different.
They switched stations and listened to Bog Off Its Crimbo in silence. 2 days ago, Gareth had answered the phone to a journalist who wanted to speak to Leo. His father had said, "I'm afraid not," and hung up. At the Wakefields' house, Trevor had been passing the telephone table and told the reporter that he quite liked Muslims but didn't think they drank enough, which was why they were sexually attracted to their cousins. And now his parents were being investigated by child services and he might have to spend Christmas in foster care in Gloucester.
Probably with a pedo, Phil Price taunted him in gym. You'll enjoy that, won't you?
But now the phones were silent. The satellite trucks and even the local reporters had left the school gates. Nobody was interested in eyewitness accounts. It was all lobby groups and pundits and politicians extending the furor to the far horizon. Pam was late for the fair committee and arrived to find everyone back to arguing about the diversity bollards. She thought that had all been resolved at the previous meeting when they decided they couldn't afford the premium models, disguised as stylish nutcracker soldiers, and would have to settle for the economy versions covered in silvery tinsel branches to look like cheap artificial Christmas trees. But the bollard controversy had evolved into a controversy over whether the Prime Minister wanted to risk paying for the bollards.
He doesn't need a scandal over paying for our security costs.
Why would there be a scandal?
Because, quote, we're hideously non-diverse, said Rajiv. But he doesn't also want headlines about Mickleham does nothing as local Christmas market closes. So their proposal is to pay for the bollards but make us a wee bit more diverse by bringing Shahid and having him present the PM with his diversity pudding.
What about my pudding? Said Pam involuntarily.
Honestly, Pam, said Isabel, yesterday you were moaning that you didn't want to give your pudding to Mickleham.
I wasn't moaning. She gave up. What's in his pudding anyway?
As I understand it, said Rajiv, it's the shell of a traditional English plum pudding, such as yours, Pam, but with layers of baklava inside, separated by some sort of, compote.
I don't believe it.
Oh, Pam, said Hugo pityingly, you sound like one of those paranoid tweeters.
He wants to do the cordon bleu, said Rajiv, but his parents were killed in Yemen.
Libya and Somalia,
said Isabel and Hugo, respectively but simultaneously.
It's not fair, protested Pam.
It's not fair losing your family in a civil war and having your boat sunk halfway across the Mediterranean and washing up on the shores of...
But Hugo found himself getting a bit vague on the details and gave up.
So he's doing the star Christmas pudding for Mr. Look at Me, and I'm doing the boring old traditional non-diverse Christmas puddings for all the extras in the crowd scene.
Last year you complained that the market was too traditional.
Which was true. She had.
Didn't you get into trouble, said Isabel, for refusing to bake a cake for a gay wedding?
That was Janet Orme, and she didn't refuse. She was on holiday in Ibiza.
Well, we haven't had a Britain in Bloom nomination in 14 years. No village can survive being both Islamophobic and homophobic. The Prime Minister sees this as a healing moment for our community.
Pam could feel her voice rising.
But we don't need healing. We all get along fine.
Everyone stared blankly at her.
Don't we?
The high street was closed to traffic for the Yuletide fair, and Pam had parked at the far end. She threaded her way on foot, back down to the car. The fair did indeed look very traditional, if nothing like the way it was in Pam's childhood. A few years ago, Rajiv had donated to the committee a set of authentically Victorian-style lampposts, which were installed every year down the centre of the temporarily pedestrianised street. They were so beautifully ornate, with hexagonal lanterns and gilded trim, that they looked utterly fantastical, as if they belonged on a stage set for Oliver or Mary Poppins, rather than in an undistinguished Cotswold village. Hugo always sponsored the Gingerbread House, which this year was a four-bedroom detached home with double garage, carport and attached conservatory, and Christmas lights that flashed sold in red and green. A reindeer and sleigh were parked on the roof, and Father Christmas was dropping a very large certified check down the chimney. Fair ushers in Dickensian garb strolled the street, offering passers-by tasty bites of Christmas kebabs and Yuletide yufka. In the designated caroling zone, Good King Wenceslas was being sung by a group of Czech plumbers from Stow-on-the-Wold. At some point, in all the years she'd been making her same old 19th-century Christmas pudding with its same old 13 ingredients, her village fair had turned into a theme park of a village fair. Pam arrived home in a fury. Ever since her mother's death, she had understood that she was responsible for the community Christmas lunch puddings because nobody else wanted to be. She had had no particular desire to do it herself, but do it she had, uncomplainingly, for years, as her mother and aunt and grandmother and great-aunts and great-grandmother had done. How dare they reduce her to a supporting role? And just because the Prime Minister wanted a whatchamacallit, a photo op, to lay his healing hands on a divided community invented by spin doctors in London. Pam decided her Christmas puddings were not going to sing backup to some Johnny-come-lately's diversity pudding. She got home and set to work on something she had only done once before, and never again, because it was such hard work. But desperate times call for snowflake wafers. Everyone different and everyone a real bitch to hand-carve an ice without wrecking the wafer.
Mum, are you okay? You're all purple.
No, Pam wasn't okay. And having to hold it in for the child wasn't helping.
Do your homework, Chloe. I'll finish up. But Mum, you've still got 15 snowflakes to do.
Pam shooed her daughter out. With 8 snowflakes to go, she went and pulled her husband away from this year's rat-assed Christmas special and insisted they go upstairs to speak to Leo.
"Mum says you won't tell her what you wanted to phone into that radio show about," said Gareth, sitting on the edge of the bed. "What was it, boyo?"
Adam looked away suddenly and then said,
"Allahu Akbar."
His dad snorted.
"You have to say it louder, so we all jump under the table like poor Mr. Harrop."
"It's not a joke, Dad. They said on the radio they were persecuting Facebook users."
"Persecuting?"
"Prosecuting Facebook users for saying that Shahid said Allahu Akbar when he produced his pudding."
Pam stood over the bed with her arms folded.
"Well, so they should, leaping to conclusions. It's totally irresponsible." "But he did say Allahu Akbar."
She pursed her lips. She and Gareth looked at each other, and then reluctantly the father turned back to the son.
"How do you know that?"
"He said it as he was walking to the front of the class, and I was nearer him than anyone except Pippa Chard, and she's too druggy to notice anything."
"So he said it quietly?"
"Yes."
"Darling Leo." Pam took his hand, and he instinctively tried to pull it back.
"Allahu Akbar is something Muslims say all the time. It's a prayer that means..."
She paused and tried to remember. Gareth leapt in to rescue her.
"God is great," he said. "So it's just like the way we would say praise the Lord."
"We never say praise the Lord."
"Well, not us literally," said Pam, "but white Christian Bible belters."
"I've never heard anyone say praise the Lord."
Leo had a petulant expression, like Gareth, when he'd stayed too late at the rugby club.
"Do they say it before giving you a Christmas pud?"
"I don't think Americans have Christmas pudding," said his dad.
"Do you think I should tell someone that he said it? The police? Or the new head?"
Pam squeezed his hand and looked at him very intently. "Leo, you must promise me you'll never tell anyone. I mean it. That awful Daily Mail woman just got fired for saying Shahid had said Allahu Akbar. You'd be throwing away everything. Shahid's at a very rough time. All he wants is to fit in by making his classmates a pudding. That's very sweet of him, really."
"But he didn't even make it himself."
Leo held up his phone.
"Look!"
He waved a grainy gif from Mum to Dad to Mum.
"What's that supposed to be?" said Gareth.
"It's the CCTV of him buying the baklava in a spa shop. Someone found it and put it on a website in Canada. We're not being allowed to see it here."
"You sound like a conspiracy theorist," said Gareth. "Mum's going to have to adjust your safe settings."
"But..."
"You can't tell anyone," said Pam, "or you'll end up in care like Trevor Wakefield." After Gareth had gone to bed, Pam went back to the kitchen and stayed there until 3 in the morning, creating an individual white chocolate snowflake to stick in the top of every one of her puddings. She was exhausted when she went to bed, yet sleep would not come, and she lay there staring at the ceiling, listening to her husband's placid, unhurried breathing. It was almost dawn on the day of the Yuletide Fair community Christmas lunch. Step 5.
"Thurf," declared Chloe with a flourish of finality. "There, that's the whole recipe."
"Bloody hell," said Gareth. "You've got a party piece that could clear Wembley Stadium."
He braked cautiously. The children were both in the back, wedged in by Christmas puddings, piled up all around, and Pam was sleep-deprived and irritable enough without any sudden swerves or stops, sending plum duffs splattering round the car. It was a frosty morning, and the demister was unreliable. On the radio, a debate about whether the unusually chilly December was due to climate change had evolved into a debate about whether it was irresponsible to allow climate deniers to participate in the debate.
"Those snowflakes look lovely on top of the puddings," said Gareth encouragingly.
"Granny wouldn't have liked it," objected Leo from the back. "It's meant to be a family pudding that stays the same for hundreds of years."
"The pudding is the same," said Chloe. "It's just something on top of the pud."
"Shh," hissed their mother.
The newsreader was saying something about Morrison's snowflake biscuits. Following complaints from students at the Norwich branch that the name of the product was triggering, the supermarket chain was withdrawing snowflake biscuits from all stores nationwide.
"It's central to our values," said the company spokesperson, "to be sensitive to all communities in our community."
The lights changed, Gareth braked, and Pam slumped forward onto the glove box.
"Are you okay, love?" asked her husband.
Behind them, Leo was waving his phone at his sister.
"Look at him, he's Dad's age."
Chloe brushed the hand aside, but she glanced at the screen.
"He's not Dad's age." "Well, he's not my age."
"Stop this," ordered their father. "You'd look older if you'd been half-starved in a civil war."
"Maybe I would," said Leo, "but I wouldn't be bigger, would I? If I were half-starved, I'd be small and spindly, not 6'3".
They were being directed into the temporary fair drop-off in the meadow across the brook from the high street.
"You're not to mention this," said Gareth, "and certainly not to your teachers."
"Why not? It's funny."
"They won't think so, if there's anyone left who hasn't been suspended."
After she dropped off Gareth and the kids, Pam pulled into the car park behind Hugo's office. She spent the next 20 minutes yanking the handmade snowflake wafers off every single pudding, and then carting them off to the rubbish bin, sobbing as she did so. But the bin had been removed for the duration, in case the fair triggered a potential extremist to self-radicalize and put a bomb in it. She stopped crying and carried the snowflakes back to the car. But she slipped on the ice and the wafers flew up like giant snowflakes, only to shatter on contact with the ground. She picked herself up, noted the rip in her coat, then went to the florist and bought holly sprigs.
"You coming down with a cold, love?" asked Mrs. Woolman. "You look a bit roomy."
Back in the car, she spent another 20 minutes sticking the sprigs into the puddings and then drove them round to the loading dock behind the village hall. Pam wiped her eyes and blew her nose before going off in search of her family. It was a weird scene outside the yurt with the organic kumis, Dickensian carolers singing an a cappella arrangement of Bog Off It's Crimbo, flanked by faceless officers in riot gear brandishing machine guns. Two soldiers were frisking a man in a reindeer suit, while a girl dressed as a sexpot elf in fishnet stockings and a fur-trimmed green bodice shivered patiently alongside. Pam spotted her family a long way to the back of a slow-moving security line and joined them shuffling forward inch by inch. It was a chilly morning, and at least two elderly ladies turned purple and collapsed, slowing the queue further as the stretcher-bearers arrived, wearing Santa hats to add a festive touch to the removal of the stricken geriatrics. As they reached the metal detector, Pam was astonished to see, a few feet away, Shahid being ushered through the VIP entrance by plainclothes detectives.
"Why doesn't he have to have his bollocks x-rayed?" asked Gareth.
"Because he's with the PM," said the security guard. "Your bollocks are cleared to go. Keep moving."
Safely inside the secure zone, they were too cold and tired to enjoy themselves. Pam was shivering, so Gareth thought they should have some warm cocoa and a Welsh tea cake. They were barely seated before Isabel came marching into the marquee to explain that the PM's people wanted a non-Muslim friend of Shahid's to join him on stage as a visual shorthand for how the Prime Minister had healed the community and indeed the nation.
"So I asked Mrs. Caulfield who his mates are, but apparently she's just been suspended too, so she told me to piss off. Not a great start to the day. So I put down your boy."
She nodded in the direction of Leo.
"All he has to do is stand next to Shahid and try not to look bored during the speeches."
She clutched Gareth's arm.
"I had no idea of what Shahid's gone through. He washed up on a beach in Italy."
"Greece," said Chloe.
"Turkey," said Leo. "For a chap who's grown up in a brutal civil war, he looks awfully well on it. Quite a strapping lad. You sure your boy's eating enough?"
So at the appointed hour for the Christmas lunch, Gareth and Chloe went to a table at the back with the Wakefields, and Pam and Leo squeezed through to the front and clambered up on stage. Leo took the seat next to Shahid, who was in his school uniform, even though it was Saturday. He had his pudding on his lap.
"I'm Leo's mum," said Pam, leaning over her son. "Lovely pud. Is that a homemade candy cane on the top?"
Up close, she noticed, Shahid had slight crow's feet and a receding hairline. War really is hell. He smiled but did not reply. Pam went to stand over by the display table where her own puddings had been arrayed, like a ceremonial pyramid of cannonballs. The local celebrity, Carrie Moonbeams, sang The Last Day of Christmas, a lugubrious ballad about environmental devastation and global eco-collapse. And then the Prime Minister took the few steps up to the stage at a bound to communicate vigour and confidence. His bound and vigour were a bit more than were justified by the muted applause, but he affected not to notice as he glad-handed Shahid and Leo and then approached the microphone. He thanked Carrie Moonbeams for her beautiful song and took the opportunity to announce that the government was partnering with the music industry on a new initiative to develop sustainable amps for rock bands. But with the best will in the world, he did go on a bit. The crowd grew restless, so he skipped ahead to the theme of healing and his pride at how an act of hate, the assumption that a Christmas pudding was a bomb, had become an opportunity to heal not only a community, but to build a new Britain. And then he announced the winner of the first Prince's Youth Award for Cultural Innovation. He waved at Shahid. and his best friend. He indicated Leo. So the winner of the first Prince's Youth Award for Cultural Innovation stood up, proffering an apparently perfectly spherical Christmas pudding with what appeared to be a homemade candy cane stuck in the top. Shahid stopped and looked down at his feet. He seemed a little shy and nervous. And then his eyes swept the room and somehow caught Pam's, and he smiled at her. He steadied the platter and held his diversity pudding outstretched toward the Prime Minister. Then he set it down again. "Oh, I forget the brandy." Pam smiled back. She'd done that herself. The audience beamed approvingly as he produced a small flask and drizzled it over the pudding. "Save some for me," said Mr. Mickleham, and everyone laughed. But Shahid upturned it all and emptied the flask. He produced a cigarette lighter, flipped it open, hoisted up the platter, and resumed his progress toward the Prime Minister. Shahid seemed to stare past him into Pam's eyes. And she knew, if only because, she thought in that instant, he wants me to know. He walked forward slowly and calmly, step by step, toward Mickleham, raising his pudding to meet the flame hovering above it. And Leo was directly behind him. "Bomb!" Pam yelled. "Get down!" And she hurled herself across the stage, stumbling awkwardly into the back of the Prime Minister. Shahid was still smiling. In that second, it seemed to Pam that she was standing on the hinge between yesterday and tomorrow. She would be the last English pudding maker, a relic of the past of no use to the future. She threw herself on the boy. Boy. He was heavy and muscular, and as their faces scraped, she felt a rough 5 o'clock shadow unknown to Leo's cheek. He did not go down easily. Pam waited for the explosion. Instead, everything was still. She stared into his eyes, and he stared back, still smiling.
"For God's sake, you bloody awful woman!"
Mickleham reached down and yanked at Pam's collar. "You're ruining everything!" From somewhere in front, she could hear Isabel say,
"What a bloody disgrace! I told you we shouldn't have had her."
Pam clambered to her feet, the Prime Minister still dragging her backwards. No one else had hit the ground, not even Leo. They were all sitting perfectly upright and looking at her pityingly as if she were insane. Shahid got up too, recovering his pudding and his lighter. She looked down. Her cardigan was wet from the brandy, but it was an odd smell, not brandy. And the pudding seemed smudged in places, no longer dark, but grey.
"Look here," said Mickleham to the boy. "I'm awfully sorry about that. Just a terribly bigoted person."
Shahid stepped forward and said, "Allahu Akbar." Pam grabbed Leo with her left hand as her right punched Mickleham in the face, and he toppled off stage and into the auditorium. She and her boy fell in after. The Prime Minister had crashed down on a display of homemade snow globes, and she landed on top of him. There was a second moment of stillness.
"You bloody mad woman!" he wheezed underneath her.
And then, a few feet above them, the first winner of the Prince's Award for Cultural Innovation lowered his lighter to the pudding and blew himself into a million pieces. The blast wave exploded, and Pam felt the heat burning her back and a 14th century village hall crashing all around. When the wood and plaster and metal had stopped falling, there was an odd, total silence. And then the screaming and sobbing began from all sides, save from the space just above Pam where the stage had been. She opened her eyes and stared into the Prime Minister's. Dust of some kind was all over him, and his mouth was hanging open, with his tongue waggling too far out, as if it were trying to escape. She could feel him shaking underneath her. Just to the side of his left ear was what looked like some of her Christmas pudding. She pulled herself up and realized it was a body part. It would emerge later that it belonged to Carrie Moonbeams. She had been ripped into pieces, so small that she could only be identified by this particular piece of her arm and a famous tattoo she had had done during her Kabbalah phase. Pam climbed off Mickleham and straightened up. Her leg didn't feel quite right, and her ears hurt. The lights had been blown out, the roof was gone, and on a short, cold December afternoon, the sky was already darkening. Everyone seemed to be howling.
"Leo?" said Pam.
"Yes, Mum," he answered from somewhere below. "I'm okay." He sounded very calm. "You saved my life." "And bloody Mickleham's," she choked. "Can you stand?" He did so, and she saw his boyish face topped by powdery white hair. "Go to your sister and your dad. I'll be along." Beyond, there was more shouting and the frenzy of hundreds of people trying to flee in all directions. At Pam's feet, someone was crawling around, apparently blinded by the blast. Where the stage had been, there was nothing, just a pile of debris shredded so small it looked like a mountain of confetti. Picking her way through the bits of wood and body parts, she realized she was crawling on what remained of Isabel. She rose and stepped over a whimpering protection officer whose legs had been blown off. And then she leaned over and saw the Prime Minister's wife lying like a broken rag doll, her right arm dangling useless. Pam felt for a pulse, but as soon as she touched her, Georgina Mickleham's eyes flashed open. "I'm fine," she snapped, "just having difficulty moving." She shook her hand free of Pam. "It's the little things that get to you. The PM's missus had been born the daughter of some broken-down country squire, but she didn't want Pam touching her." She stared down at Mrs. Mickleham for a moment and then stepped over her and through the shattered side of the village hall. There were more bodies, and in the crepuscular gloom, the high street seemed to be on fire. Mrs. Mickleham's slight was so vivid, it revived Pam's senses. She could see and hear and smell and feel. And at a moment when she had never felt so full of life, it came to her that she was sticky. And she reached behind to touch her back. She removed her fingers and examined them. They were wet with dark red. She stared down, not quite understanding, and then put her other hand behind to where the blood was pooling and pressed the digits against her blouse. She was surprised how squishy she was, like a Christmas pudding mix all macerated. Soak it up Saturday. And then her legs buckled and she was on the ground, listening to the screaming, and staring up at the sky filled with a beautiful snowfall, the flakes dancing in the dark to land softly on her face. No, it wasn't snow. It was dust, ash, plaster, the remnants of Shahid and Isabel and Carrie Moonbeams. And she stared in wonder as the flakes fell on the Christmas stalls and Rajiv's Victorian lampposts. Christmas bells were chiming, and for a moment it was heavenly. But they were mechanical, like St. Giles's, and they jammed and were stuck playing the same chime and a half over and over. She told herself a joke. "Ask not for whom the bell toll, the bell toll, the bell toll." And she wished Gareth were here to enjoy it. The stickiness was all around now. Pam thought of her puddings, all lovingly handmade, and wondered whether any had survived. But no, that was silly. They were all gone, except for the lucky sixpences blasted into the sky to shower those below with good fortune. Like her dad all those years ago when he found the sixpence and tossed it up into the air and she caught it before her brother did. Pam seemed to see someone looking down on her, a man with a kindly expression. Keith, was it? Or Hugo? And she tried to speak, but he didn't understand. She was cold now and strained to keep her eyes open, and when they closed, she was in her mother's kitchen, standing on a chair and stirring batter with a big wooden spoon and flour all down her apron. But the kitchen seemed to evaporate in a great light, and she was a 7-year-old playing a wise man in St. Giles's nativity play, seeing a star in the east rising and filling her sight. She could hear voices now, but not the words. And in the last lucid moment of her life, the phrase "Stir Up Sunday" popped into her head, but she could no longer recall the meaning. And anyway, why would you want to stir everybody up?
Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time is a production of Oak Hill Media and Mark Stein Enterprises. All rights reserved.